Well, thank you, Mr. Smith. As much as I do enjoy coming down here, I think the so often the he hit the hail in the head there a little bit with a good cup of coffee will be just fine. I don't need to speak when I come down. Everybody has asked, where is my lovely wife? She is still lovely, but she is in Ohio, and literally right now in Pennsylvania they have an annual get-together, and I wasn't invited. I'm kidding. I was invited, but I miss being back there. But I was invited to a wedding. Our family was out in California, so I got to see the Kozier clan and quite a few other people up in Northern California. They did have me leave my Los Angeles credentials in the Bay Area because, as you know, Northern California doesn't particularly care for Southern California because we're stealing their water. And so that was a topic of conversation up there. So Becky is back east, and I pray for safe travels, and we'll pick her up next week. So she sends all of you her greetings, as well as so many people. Ay, 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 what a list. They said, well, you're going to San Diego, you know, please say hi. So everybody in Eagle Rock says hello to you. As Mr. Kozier mentioned, this is a very historic week, last few days in particular. I think it's the message he had, I think, obviously is very appropriate. Mine was prepared prior to this week, but maybe it will give a little bit of perspective. If you came by car today, I don't know if any of you walked here. How many of you came by car? Either you drove or somebody else drove. So the vast majority of you did. If you did, there were probably three of these items in your car. Two of them are mandated by law in the state of California. You cannot drive without them. And what are they? Well, they're usually rather oblong, long. Rarely are they round anymore. They're usually shiny on one side, reflective on one side, and usually matte on the other. They're covered. Some are motorized. In fact, I know of one automobile who has these accoutrements, and they actually dip when you back up. What are they? Well, let me show you. Anybody have any guesses? Your steering wheel? No, you don't have three steering wheels in a car. What? Yeah, your rearview mirrors. Well, I brought one. I have one right here. Now, your pulpit won't allow me to put this whole thing on, so I'll just set it here. Now, the guy that I took this from is not happy. No, it came off of one of my cars. Now, your next question may be, what are you doing without the right rearview mirror? Well, it had to be replaced. And so I thought I'd bring this to you. I'll just set this here for a minute. Will that fit? If it falls, it doesn't matter. It was only $200 to get it replaced. That's okay. But it's worthless now. Your rearview mirror is something that is a fact of every car that is driven in the state of California. Some of you may have a camera attached to your car as well. In fact, I understand that by 2016-17 model cars, they will be mandatory. How many of you have a camera? A couple of you do. I have a lease car that the company gives me, and I have the camera. Do you know how many times I've almost hit people looking in the mirror? I was so fascinated by it. So technically, I have four methods by which I can rear-end cars with the back of my car. But they're important. Why are they important? Well, they're important, number one, because it's the legal law of the land. You have to have them. But they're used specifically for two reasons, I think we would agree, and those reasons are important. To see what is coming behind you. That's why those cameras are so important. We understand that it's mandatory to look back where you, what's behind you. You also see things that are beside you. I even have a little mirror on both of my rearview mirrors. It has a magnifying mirror. How many of you have those? They have those on usually big trucks. Now, I understand those are going to be mandatory on automobiles. And what it literally does is shows you what is right next to you. That's important, too, don't you think? That's known as the Pauli exclusion principle in chemistry. It means that two bodies cannot occupy the same space at the same time. Okay, that was a bad joke, right? But we need to understand that this is what they're for. My daughter, I'm going to put this down because I'm afraid it's going to fall down. My daughter picked up a new car a few months ago, and we checked them out, as you should on Consumer Report, and people had them in the reviews, and we went to go buy one. And it's a beautiful car, and she bought it. And she has 14 or 15 rearview mirrors on that car. There are side bags, airbags, rearview mirrors all over that car. We were driving back from the dealership, and I was with her, and all of a sudden we heard this beep, beep, beep coming out of the rearview mirror. And I said, honey, what's that? She said, well, that's a sensor, Dad, that when a car is within 5 feet of us, it sounds a warning. You know, some of you are nodding like, yeah, this is everyday stuff. Yeah, right, sure. And so all these sensors are all over this car. I said, but what's that in the middle of the dash? She said, that's the latte maker. Don't touch it. So the reasons, again, are obvious. They're for safety. They're for you, and they're for the people that are around you. My life in Southern California, I grew up in Southern California. I've lived in many different places, as many of you have. But it's always been surrounded by cars. In Southern California, when I grew up, you either had one of two kinds of cars, neither of which you could afford. Well, you could afford one. The other one you couldn't afford. And that was a Mustang, right, in the 60s and 70s. Or what was the other car? Volkswagen. There's a Chevy guy. No, a Volkswagen. My family did not drive Chevrolets. Other people did. And so you may find interesting, my dad was in racing in the 30s in Los Angeles when there was nothing in Los Angeles. And in the 30s in auto racing, do you know how many rearview mirrors they had in those cars? None. They had none. They had a riding mechanic, and he was supposed to look out, but that was too much dead weight. So they got rid of the driver, but they didn't install rearview mirrors. It wasn't until there were crash and death and crash and death one after another, they slowly put them on the automobiles. Now, you may know if any of you follow NASCAR. Both of you? Good. Formula One? Another two of you? Good. This is good. This is the racing crowd. Good to hear. They will tell you some cars will have no rearview mirrors, which makes traveling at 100 to 200 miles an hour very dangerous. So they're important, and I can't think of anyone that would drive without them. When I was young, I don't want to talk about this message, isn't about me, but when I was young in Southern California, the police were very rude, they were very mean, and I think they over-focused on my driving. Yes, if you got three, you went to the bad place. And you went for 6 to 7 weeks of driver training where you watched films of death and destruction. But I remember one thing that the CHP officer who taught it, I remember one thing he said long, long ago. When I drive, he said, I use my rearview mirror 50% of the time. So try not to speed when the CHP is in front of you because he looks in his rearview mirror. They're that important, and I never, ever forgot that. And that is the second reason, to see what's beside you, but also the second reason to see what is behind you and where you have been. Where you have been, if just for a fleeting moment. How many of you have, in your rearview mirror, just happened to catch a sunset or the mountain range that you passed? Well, my family knows that when that happens, we get out of the car, we stop, and we look. Because sometimes we can see on the map where we're going, but sometimes we don't know where we've been. And sometimes it requires us to get out of the car, stop, and what we saw in the rearview mirror, this very, very small area, to see the expanse of what's behind us. Many times, I'm sure your family has traveled during the feast to a new and a different area. We were blessed to go to Hawaii last year, and I tell you, I kept looking in the rearview mirrors of where we'd been, not where we were going. That caused some difficulty with my wife from time to time of not looking where I was going and looking more importantly where we had been. And we would get out quite frequently, and we'd look at the beautiful panorama that was behind us, and it was indeed gorgeous. And I think it's important because it gives us a completely, utterly different perspective. Where we are going in that big, wide windshield, the side windows that we have. But it only shows us maybe 60 to 70% of our vision. It doesn't show us anything about where we have been. So that's the perspective that I'd like to bring to you today. Because many times we can think about other people. We can think about everything to do with us. And many times it's not about us, but it's about who has brought us where we are. And that's why I've entitled this Shock Upon Shock, Rearview Mirror. If with that as a backdrop, if you turn with me, please, to Psalm 77, and we will spend all of our time here. We'll make some very small side references to other parts of Scripture, but I thought about this a lot recently, and as I guess one gets older and one has grandchildren, children and then grandchildren, sometimes perspective is very important. And I happened upon this psalm quite a while ago, and it came to mind just recently. And I thought maybe it was important, and maybe the importance I saw to me may extend to you. It may, in fact, tie in to a small degree with the first message and what's happened this last week. So, the psalm will hopefully apply to all of us. And I think that's what the psalms are for. In fact, we sang, I tried to count them, the hymns that we sing, the vast, overwhelmingly majority of our hymns are, what are they? They're the psalms. Do you realize that most of our songs were taken from a specific book? The Bible, I know. But a music book, do you know what that book is? It's a Scottish Psalter. If you look at the origination of many of our hymns, the tunes are taken from the Psalter. The Psalter means the Psalms. And we see the Psalms as a great, great importance. What was the Scripture reading many times? It's the Psalms. The Psalms are important because they are universally applicable to all of us. So hopefully that will apply today. Sometimes when we think about reading the Bible and we think that it does speak to us, we also need to remember that as we speak with one another. And as you speak with one another, and I know the elders, we would agree, people talk to us a little differently. And sometimes that's a good thing, and sometimes it's about some sad things that we have to deal with. But when we speak with one another, we will often hear those that are in doubt, those that have fears, those that are going through some trial, some unexpected, some severely unexpected, health issues and others, different trials. None of these trials, none of these events in their life, they surely were not wanted. No one prays for bad things to happen. They just happen. They're not wanted, but they happen. Some people, as they read the Psalms and speak with one another, will often be reflective. We'll just reflect back on our lives. Especially after something has happened, something tragic in your life has occurred, you will reflect back. You will think. You will remember. And that's important. Whether we are very, very young, not so young, I think these words in Psalm 77 will apply. This psalm is a very interestingly structured psalm because it does have some great structure behind it. And I'd like you to pay close attention to it, to the personal pronouns or some of the words that are used, because they are repetitive. When literature, I'm sure when you were in school you heard this, when they are repetitive, it is for a reason, a specific reason. When you write a letter, or you even write, people don't write letters anymore, but they write posts. And it's a long post. Every once in a while we get a long email in us to send to someone else. Do you take any care in how you write that? Sure you do. Sure, you take time, and if it's a heavy-hearted post or something you've got to tell someone, you take a lot of time in structuring it. If you don't, you should. But those people that do, you can see the pattern of their writing. And this is a psalm of Asaph, the chief musician, and it has some great structure, and we're going to note some of it as we go along. I want you to notice that it begins very inwardly directed. It's very self-centered. You're going to see it and pick it up very quickly. It becomes very inwardly directed, and then, as the commentaries tell us, there is a shift in both genre, syntax, and also meter. For those of you that are musically inclined, it goes from the meter of 3 plus 3 to 3 plus 3 plus 3. It has an apex where it changes focus, marked by the word that we see often, Selah, which is borderline untranslatable. But its most important aspect is that because this is God's word, this is in our Bibles and has been in our Bibles for thousands of years, it therefore is important. And therefore it is inspired by God's Spirit. And that makes it the important words we read. So although it's 2,000 years old and you're wondering, when am I going to get to it? Just a minute, we will. I believe it is applicable to my life and it is applicable to your life. We sing about them. We read them. They're important. So in all of this, maybe we will see ourselves. Maybe we will see some answers. because when we look forward, we often need to look back. So, Psalm 77. Verse 1. A psalm of Asaph. I cried out to God with my voice, to God with my voice, and he gave ear to me. In the day of my trouble, I sought the Eternal. My hand was stretched out in the night without ceasing. My soul refused to be comforted. I remembered God and was troubled. I complained and my spirit was overwhelmed. Selah. There is so much right here. I cried with my voice twice. I cried to God with my voice. He listened to me. So the writer says he knows that God is indeed listening to me. He says he remembers God and he was troubled. That's not good. That's bad. He says, I complained. My spirit, my ruach, was overwhelmed. And when we say that, we can maybe identify with that. When your spirit is overwhelmed, more than likely everyone in this room, I have, where you are overwhelmed by the situation, whatever it may be. The writer is indeed telling us that he is at his wit's end. As we'll see, it gets worse. He's at his limit. The issue we're not even told about. We really aren't. But it's obviously he is distraught. He is troubled. He calls on God. But seemingly God hears, but God does not seemingly come. He stretches out his hands. I don't know if you have it. In many cases, people in the, we'll call it the Oriental or the East, they will lay prostrate in front of God. Total submission. Begging God. He says this. He stretched out his hands, pleading with God. The word then says Selah. It's really of an unknown meaning. I always am fascinated by people who think they know what it means, but even the commentaries say it's maybe a musical or a poetical remark or mark point, designation of a break. So we'll take it at that. That's as good as any. He continues in verse 4. You hold my eyelids open. I am so troubled I cannot speak. I have considered the days of old, the years of ancient times, I call to remembrance my song in the night. I meditate within my heart, and my spirit makes diligent search. You can tell, he is absolutely distraught. He is absolutely overwhelmed. And I think it's important that we try to remind ourselves that we may have been in those situations. He basically cannot sleep. He says his eyelids are being held open. He can't find any rest. His mind races. He tries to recall his songs in the night, which means possible hymns that were told him when he was young. And again, we can relate to this. Everyone. It is the human condition to be able to relate to this. We too have been concerned with health issues, financial issues, relationships at school and church, and just plain everyday normal life. It is overwhelming often. It is our job. Our government, our city, our state, our rulers, all those things seek against us to trouble us. We become worried about them. This was a week of worry. I'm sure you heard or you saw the news. The conservative TV stations or networks were seemingly catatonic. They couldn't believe this happened. The more liberal news stations, and I try and listen to them all, well, it's about time. It's about time. And it has troubled the nation for many, many different reasons. It's all about being distraught, overwhelmed with life. And at some point, as many of us do, and as the psalmist does here, he begins to question. There always, always are questions. When you have no answer, you have no relief, you then start to question. And those questions, they're not good questions. There are questions that we don't like asking. Someone recently commented on a message I gave a long time ago about Romans 7, which is, oh, wretched man that I am. You know, I do the things I shouldn't be doing. I don't do the things I should be doing. Oh, wretched man that I am, who shall take me away from this body? And he said something very interesting. This person said, it was good to know that even Paul struggled with life. Paul struggled with life. Paul had horrible doubts. This writer of the Psalms, this isn't a psalm of praise. It isn't a psalm, it's not uplifting. It's very sad. So even the great writers and speakers, the apostles of our Bibles, they had trouble. Overwhelming trouble. And many of them, as we know, died for it. Let's go back to the psalm. So now we begin with the questions. The psalmist begins to question God, just as we may. In fact, there are six questions, almost in just rapid machine gun staccato fire. Verse 7, will the Eternal cast off forever? And will He be favorable no more? Has His mercy ceased forever? Has His promise failed forevermore? Has God forgotten to be gracious? Has He in anger shut up His tender mercies? This isn't polemic. This isn't the writer just saying this to say it rhetorically. He's talking about his prayer. He said how distraught he was. He basically is saying, has God left me? Has God just completely deserted me? What about all the things He said? What about all the promises He made? What about all the grace that He said I was supposed to have? What about all that? Why am I in this mess? How did this happen to me? I'm sure I'm speaking about myself. Because I'm sure none of you have ever gone through any of what the psalmist. So since you haven't, try and relate to me and the psalmist. I kid. I know we all have. I know we all have gone through this. These six questions are horrible, horrible questions. Notice that four of them are time-oriented. Forever, no more, forever, forevermore. This means eternity. Has He forgotten me for eternity? Forever. Will God ever help me? Will God ever pull me out of this? And this is part of the common human condition. Did God forget me? Is God angry with me? What did I do? I must have done something horrible. It's all about who? It's all about me. It's all about me. So let's blame God. It's His fault. It's His fault. So let's blame Him. And that's what essentially He is doing. But note at this point there is a key juncture. In the ancient world, as we know, many people felt that when bad things happened, what did the people around them say to that person? Well, it's obvious you've done something wrong, right? It's obvious that you're being punished by God for your sinful nature. I've heard people say that about people. Well, the reason you caught that disease, have you seen their lifestyle? And yes, we know that diet and things like that can lead to sickness. But in many ways, anciently, it was tied together. Trouble and sickness was a direct result of sin. I'm sick. I've got this because I am a sinner. There was always a direct link. And again, we're very aware that bad health, bad eating, bad choices, bad habits, but it surely cannot and does not and will not ever explain why so many people go through the trials they do. Because we are all under the death penalty. Everyone in this room is under the death penalty. This entire society is under the death penalty. And we know that without God's mercy and the sacrifices of His Son, Jesus Christ, we will be under that death penalty. The psalmist develops this point to the point that you'll see that he starts to change or shifts his focus. C.S. Lewis wrote on this related subject, "The self can be regarded in two ways. On the one hand, it is God's creature, an occasion of love and rejoicing, now indeed hateful in condition, but to be pitied and healed. On the other hand, it is that one self of all others which is called I and me, and which on that ground puts forward an irrational claim to preference. The claim is to be not only hated, but simply killed. Never, as George MacDonald has said, to be allowed a moment's respite from eternal death." He's saying it's about self. It's about me. I want you to look in these verses later if you have time and if you wish to, where the personal pronoun is my voice, my ear, my trouble, my soul, my spirit. And when he gets to God, it's you're not helping me, you've forgotten me, you've left me. you broke your promise. So, it's all about self. And then we read a change in verse 10, and it is a tremendous change. And he uses the verse 10 is a pivot point. It's a perspective on pivot points. No longer about him, his soul, his hand, his spirit, his sleep, his thoughts. Verse 10 says, and I said, this is my anguish or my torment. But he says, I will remember the years of the right hand of the Most High. That is a very, very important phrase. It's very important for a number of reasons. Number one, it talks about something called the Most High, his right hand. The right hand of God was a very important theological concept in the Old Testament. It was with the right hand that God did what? More than any other. One act more than any other with God's right hand. It was with a high hand. By the way, a high right hand. Those of us that are left-handed feel a little slighted, but that's okay. We'll live with it. Right? If you look in a mirror, it looks okay. Right? With a right hand, high right hand, God did what? Israel from the Red Sea, Exodus, over and over and over again, is with God's strong hand. Excuse me. And so he uses this phrase here, which is significant. It is with a high hand God rescued Israel. Behold the right hand and the high hand of God. Who sits at God's right hand? Jesus Christ sits at God's right hand. This is a very important and powerful position. So when the psalmist says, this is my anguish, but I will remember the years of the right hand of the Most High. He then begins in these following verses to talk about God. I will remember, there it is again, the works of the Eternal. Surely I will remember your wonders of old. I will also meditate on all your work and talk of your deeds. Notice the shift in the pronouns from my to you or yours or your. Verse 13, your way, O God, is the sanctuary, the holy place. Who is so great as our God? You are the God who does wonders. You have declared your strength among the peoples. This is important and this is significant. He talks about God's works, God's wonders, God's deeds. What's interesting is the noting on the names. Those that believe in sacred names will have a major, major problem with these verses. In verse 10, it's Elyon. Verse 11, it's Yah. Verse 13, it's Elohim twice and El once. Verse 14, it's Ha'el. He goes by all these different names. He is so powerful. He is the one, the only one. He is the great God, the eternal God. And the focus is indeed on God, and the focus is on what God has done. Not what has happened to me, but what God has done, the wonders. And in many ways, he talks about this from the standpoint of what he has done, wonders and works and great miracles in the lives of his people and in the lives, as we'll see, of the psalmist. It's important. It's critically important. The sanctuary in verse 13, the HaKodesh, could mean a holy place or the holy of place, holy of holies. It's where God is. It's where God is located, wherever that may be, the sanctuary. We won't turn there, but Ephesians 4 and Hebrews 4:16 tell us that we have access to this very throne in this very sanctuary that the psalmist tells us about through the sacrifice of Jesus Christ. So this is a very important. He says, your way, O God, is in the sanctuary. Who is so great a God as our God? You are the God who does wonders and miracles. It's a point of perspective. It's also, as verse 11 points out, the word remember is used in this section three times. What is remember? This is remember. This is the remember. You can see everybody. Can you see yourself? Never thought of that. Right? But you can also see what you've been through and where you have been. You also will know what God has done. And so the psalmist says, I will remember the years. I will remember the works. Surely I will remember your wonders. Why is that so important? It's perspective. It's the perspective of what is, and where do we remember the perspective of in your mind? In your mind. If you want a good movie to see with the kids, and it's a kind of a cartoon. It's the new Disney film, I think it's Inside Out. And it talks about, it's not a spiritual movie, but it's a fascinating study of the memories. The memories that we hold, all the memories that we've had all our lives. Some of those we can't remember. Some of those that are called to mind when we need them. But our memory is always on. It's always recording. You've always had it on. It's like a camera in the car that videos where you've been and what's happened to you all your life. From the day you were born, it starts recording. All the times when you were a child. Wouldn't you love to go back in time and see the world that you saw when you were one or two or three, when everything was so simple, everything was wonderful, right? There was just mom and you and dad when he remembered you were alive. It was very simple. But it's been recording all your life. Every waking moment, it's been recording. And the psalmist says, I will remember. It is the view from behind. What has God done for us? The good things. Where one has been. What has someone been through and experienced? In Deuteronomy 8:10, basically it says that when you are full, when you've come into the land and your stomach is full, after you have planted and harvested and eaten, after your stomach is full, say thank you to God. Not before. It's a very interesting thing in many Jewish homes. They will say a prayer when? After the meal. After the meal. That's where it comes from. After you are eaten and are full. Dear God, I'm not saying you shouldn't before. We did last night. We said a prayer before the meal. We thanked God for the meal. And then we thank the cook. We should. Bad, bad move, guys, to not thank the cook, especially when your wife is not in town and someone else has cooked for you. You say thank you. But also it would be important to say maybe thank you to God, because now you know what all that food on the table was for. You were hungry before, and now you are full. And I'm sure during your prayers and our prayers, we thank God for presenting this, but even more so after. We look back. The idea is we look back to see how God has ordered our life. How many times, unseen, over and over again, He has provided for us. Over and over again, He has rescued us. Sometimes, sometimes we know that He has rescued us and we didn't know it at the time. We always say hindsight is 40-40, right? No, it's 10-10. No, hindsight is 20-20. Why do we say that? Because when we have a chance to stop and reflect backwards, our eyesight and our mind is perfect. That's why that happened. Well, that's why that occurred. I didn't like it when it happened. But had not this happened, and then this bad thing happened, this good thing happened. Joseph said to his brothers, right, just before the Israelites were in Egypt, he said, what you did, you what? Meant for evil. But God meant it for good. It is only after, when he's in the pit, it's only after when he's been arrested and thrown into jail, he couldn't have said, well, there's got to be something good out of this. Yeah, that's what I always say. I always say when there's something bad happens, I know something really good is going to happen here. No, I don't. It's only upon reflection, it's only upon looking in the rearview mirror that we can sometimes see all the ways that God has delivered us. In verse 15, the psalmist now has made the transition in verses 10 through 14. In 15, he uses a highly structured set of verses that are very obvious in the way we have them numbered here. As you know, there were no verse differences with numbers on them in the original. But I want you to, as we read this, the psalmist does a very interesting set of verses. It's called either an inversion or a chiasm, where verses at the beginning and at the end come to a central point in the middle. So it builds to a point, and then it builds away from that point to another conclusion. But there's a central point, and that's called the chiasm or the inversion. It's highly structured in what he says. And the words that he uses, it's a historical setting. The words that he uses here, I've written down here. He goes from people, personalities, to water, to the heavens, back to water, back to the people. So he starts with people, goes to water, subject is water, the subject then is in the heavens, back to the water, back to the people to tell his story. It's a very famous story. It's a story that's extremely important. In fact, it references back to, to his high hand. And so let's read it with that understanding and think of the writing style that he has and the premeditation that he had in writing this for you and for me to read. So when you look at this, we read, I want you to think of your life. I want you to think of the years in your life, all of them, where God has stepped in. Where he leaves no footprints, where he leaves no evidence. But in hindsight, was always there. So in verse 15, it says, you have with your arm redeemed your people, the sons of Jacob and Joseph. The waters saw you, O God, the waters saw you. They were afraid. The depths also trembled. The clouds poured out water, the skies of the heavens out a sound. Your arrows also flashed about. The voice of your thunder was in the whirlwind. The lightning lit up the world. The earth trembled and shook. Your way was in the sea, your path in the great waters, and your footsteps were not known. You led your people like a flock by the hand of Moses and Aaron. Isn't that beautiful? You knew at every step, at every verse, you knew exactly what he was talking about. Didn't you? It's the Exodus. The Exodus for the psalmist here was almost 500 years earlier. Five centuries had passed between the psalm that we read here and the Exodus. 5 centuries. Yet, he still remembered it. The stories were important. But it also applies to the wonders that God does on an individual basis, no less. It says that God, who left no footprints, was always there. It says, we say in the New Testament, he will never leave us or forsake us. He is always there. Never leave us nor forsake us. And that is, oh, bless your heart. I think this is like the third time in my life, 30 years of had a drink during, not a drink, I meant a water during. Thank you again. And so God is always there. I feel it's important because when we can see the world around us and what's happened this last week, brethren, I tell you, I think that we will look upon the years now. We will long for these years because these years now will look normal. They will look good compared to what we know will happen. Many of you, I'm sure, have talked with each other about this week and the things that are happening all over the country and around the world. Guess what? This is what we have prayed for. Did we pray for the Supreme Court decision? Yes, we didn't. Did we ask for the return of Jesus Christ? I heard it today. Yes, we did. Well, to get there, we have to be here. To be here, we've got to go through this. This will look good. We will long for the days of 2015. We will say those days were wonderful compared to what we will experience before Christ's return. Will it happen tomorrow? Absolutely not. I think it'll take many, many years. If you think this is bad, this stuff looks good. So at the end of the day, what I think is very poignant, that the Exodus is used. But each one of us have gone through individually. And it is important to look at that rearview mirror. You each have one. Your car's got 3, maybe 4. But you have one that's even more powerful. It records. It reminds. It should instill hope with you and for you. And what's interesting is that we use the Exodus. There were thousands and thousands of people that experienced the Exodus. But each of us in this room have not seen, and nor do we still have, the same rearview mirror. Mine doesn't look like yours. Mine doesn't act like yours. Mine didn't record what yours recorded. Every one of the recordings in this room are utterly and completely and statistically unique. Even your husband or your wife or your kids or your closest friend, their recording of their life has nothing to do with yours. You may have intersected at a few places. I think it is important that God wants us to recall, as the psalmist did, not what we have had bad happen to us, but what good God has done for us and to us and because of us. That He has led us individually through an Exodus, through the waters. Each one of us had a Pharaoh, maybe many Pharaohs in our lives that seek to destroy us and hurt us. It goes by any name and go by every name. And each and every time God has delivered us, He always, always provides a way. He has provided a way. We need to remember that. And it is very difficult. God never forgets. He never misses. Never lost for time. He's never late. He's never early. He's always exactly on time. He's perfect in the way that He helps. He never sleeps. He never stops watching. Not ever. We talk about it during the Exodus, the night to be much observed. Who's the one doing observing? It isn't us. The night of observing has nothing to do with us. It's He who watches over Israel. So He is always, always watching. He may not act as we would. In fact, thank God, I'm not God. Can you imagine if I was the high hand in your life? You'd be dead by now. And sorry, thank goodness you're not the God in my life. But God is God in each of our lives. He may not act as we would. He may not always provide the answer we want. But as we heard in the first message, He's the one that makes the rules. He's the one that made the rearview mirror. He's the one that wants you to remember and to recall and bring up the wonderful things in your life. It is in the reflecting and the looking back, as the psalmist has said, it is in the reflection and the looking back in a rearview mirror that sometimes we truly see and we truly appreciate. So when you go home tonight, or better yet, when you need a better view of life, use your rearview mirror.